All right. Well, we've been studying the book of Ruth, and we're back in this book for 2 weeks. And if you remember, in Ruth chapter 1, verse 1, in the time of the judges, which is about 12 to 1400 years before Christ was born, it was a time of, well, I'm trying to think, really I say this, really all times are a time of sin and folly, but it was especially dark, at least in the nation of Israel at that time. And the story tells us how in a little town of Bethlehem, there was a family of Elimelech, and he had a wife named Naomi, and they had two sons. Elimelech meant my God is king, and Naomi meant pleasant, and they had two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, and that meant sick and dying. And what happens is that a famine comes to the land of Bethlehem, which is, again, ironic, because that was the house of bread. It was a fruitful place. And famine breaks out, and we noted that maybe this was God's judgment. We don't know for certain, but this is a time of the judges, and that maybe because of their stubbornness, their hard-heartedness, we don't know, but they have lack. And Elimelech makes a decision to travel some 50 miles to the land of Moab. And he sojourns there. And remember what sojourning means? Yeah, you're going to go there and travel, but you're going to reside there temporarily. You're going to reside there temporarily, but he dies. His sons grow up and they marry two Moabite women, Ruth and Orpah. And we don't know the details, but Elimelech moved there to preserve his family's life, but they end up dying. The boys die. And that leaves these three women destitute. They don't have any means to care for themselves. Orpah, Ruth, and Naomi. And Naomi hears that in chapter 1 that God has visited his people and that there's bread back in the house of bread, and he's blessing them. The famine's over, and so her desire is to return and be there with her people, her home people. And so she at least starts out with her two daughters-in-law, and they begin the journey home. And then along the way, it dawns on Naomi that she has nothing to offer these young women. They probably shouldn't venture into Bethlehem because they wouldn't fit in. And so she stops along the road and she tries to encourage Orpah and Naomi to go back to the land of Moab, to go back home. And we know that that Ruth had, at least at this point, she commits herself to the God of Israel. And that closes out chapter 1. Chapter 2, the narrator begins to give a glimmer of hope. You know, it's a little bit of a little did they know situation. The scene shifts to where these two widows are essentially, they're basically facing starvation. They don't have what they need to live. They don't have anything to eat. They're hungry. They're poor. They're destitute. And Ruth looks at her mother-in-law and she says, "May I have your permission to go and glean in the fields?" And she goes by, and it just so happens that she shows up in a man named Boaz's fields. And it's God's providence that she ends up there. And the writer makes it clear that Boaz is a very generous, he's very kind, he's very concerned about foreigners, and he goes above and beyond the call of the spirit of the law, and he treats her with loving kindness, with everything. And so Ruth goes there, she works for 6 to 7 weeks, and in chapter 3, Naomi devises a plan. We looked at last time. And it's a story that's filled with tension. It's a story that's filled with just really what's happening here. But Ruth they devise a plan and they go to the threshing floor at the time where that they're done with the grain harvest. And she suggests that Boaz is her kinsman redeemer. And of course he's shocked, you know, who is this? You know, and he's like, oh, and he understands, well, may you be blessed of the Lord for what you're doing and everything that goes with that. But he goes, look, there's somebody that's a closer kinsman redeemer than I am, but let me get it figured out. And you remember she leaves, and she comes back home, and she tells Naomi what has happened, and he's like, he won't rest until he's settled this matter. And in this, we see that God's is concerned about the weak. He's concerned about the orphan, the widow, the helpless, the hopeless, the foreigner, the one who's on the outside. And Boaz serves as a wonderful example of how God intervenes on behalf of those who can't save themselves. And so they work within the bounds of the law, of God's law, to ensure that he's the one that is going to be able to providentially care for Ruth. And so there's a lot of obstacles, but this is the last one in God's working. And there's a tension again, at least from the tension in the story. Read it. Will Boaz become the one that takes care of Ruth, or is this other Mr. So-and-so going to be the one that takes care of Ruth? And so let's start on there. There's an outline if you want to follow along. Just has a general what happens in this chapter. We'll look at the first 12 verses. But Boaz here, he steps up, he steps in to secure her redemption of Ruth and Naomi in the first two verses. It says, now Boaz went up to the gate and sat down there. And so Boaz leaves the threshing floor. He leaves the everything, the harvest behind, and he goes to the town gate. This is a place that you took care of business. It was a public place. It was a well-known location. People would pass by there. Probably in ancient Israel, it was like a courthouse. You know, this is where a lot of transactions took place, a lot of things that were legal proceedings, or if you wanted to maybe have a cup of coffee, I don't know. But they would...
They had Starbucks there.
Yeah, they did. But, yeah, every good and perfect gift comes down from the Father of lights. Yeah, amen. And so he says, I need to... And what he's thinking, he goes, I need to get myself in the presence of this man, this kinsman redeemer, the one who's legally first in line to redeem the land, and Ruth and Naomi. And so he shows a lot of wisdom. He's very tactful. He makes sure that he's doing this with integrity. He's being just making sure that he handles it in the right way. And he puts himself in the pathway of this man. And it's you really have to note again the providence of God. This guy just, and the text says it, at least in the New American, it says, and behold, the closest relative of whom Boaz was speaking passes by. Okay. He's signaling that, I mean, at least to the reader, that this isn't normal. He's come by. Boaz might have waited for some time. Maybe he'd wait for a long time. He's like, oh boy, I gotta get back to work, but I'm coming here again. But suddenly he appears and then prepares the way for what follows. And it has to be, and we read it and we know that this is a divine appointment. It's a divine appointment. God's arranged this and God's orchestrating it. And that makes me think about how do we normally see our day, our interruptions, the guy who cuts us off in traffic, the everything. Is God truly Lord? Is he orchestrating what's happening in your life? He is. It may be painful. It may be a time of loss. Maybe a time of sickness. But God's in control. God's orchestrating everything. And so this guy comes by and he says to him, turn aside, friend, sit down here. And he turned aside and sat down. So far, so good. And what you notice that's interesting in this verse, the way he addresses the closest relative. The Hebrew words, two of them are poloni alimony. It's a rhyming expression that was known as basically John Doe. It's an idiom in the Hebrew language. The idea is Mr. So-and-so. Now, he doesn't name this man. I don't know if the writer, if it was known, but he's not named. And maybe that was to protect him, maybe. Maybe to protect his family. I'm not sure. But he says, turn aside, friend. Sit down. And you know, and then the irony that's here too, the guy that was so concerned about the preservation of his family name when he realized what's going on, we don't know his name. So Boaz knows him by his name and he calls him by it, and the holy writer admitted it because it wasn't necessary for us to know it. And this story, you read a story, and maybe it's lacked a villain. Maybe the famine was a villain. I don't know. Death is a villain. But Mr. So-and-so, he's done nothing for these women at this point. He is the closest relative. He should have been like, oh, I need to care for them. I need to redeem the land. I need to do something for these women who were on the brink of being destitute, or maybe they were, and he hasn't done anything. They're new to town, and it appears that at least he hasn't even gone to visit them. He doesn't say, how are you doing? And so he calls, he sits down, and then Boaz informs the closest relative about Naomi's land and his desire to redeem it if he isn't willing. verses 3 and 4. So he says to him, he said to the closest relative, Naomi, who has come back from the land of Moab, has to sell a piece of land which belonged to our brother Elimelech. So I thought to inform you, saying, buy it before those who are sitting here and before the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if not, tell me, that I may know, for there is no one but you to redeem it, and I am after you. And he said, I will redeem it. Boaz initiated this conversation. He describes the land that she has, or that she's selling. The text is, commentators or scholars talk about, well, wait a minute, what? Maybe they rented out their land to someone, and it's just a little unclear. But he reminds him that he's closest relative. So if him as a closest relative, redeemer, ignores his family responsibility to marry Ruth and produce an heir, then the line of Elimelech will die off without an heir, and the land would automatically default to this closest relative's ownership. And I don't know if Boaz is giving him the benefit of the doubt here. But he doesn't have the option of ignoring these two ladies. He's got to do something about it now. Boaz puts a matter of redeeming Elimelech's property to the closest relative, and he puts it in a way that makes him realize he's either got to redeem it or he's got to renounce his right to do so. And Boaz makes it clear, too, in that if this guy says, I don't want the land, I will redeem it. And so he says next, let me inform you, basically. I'm sure you didn't know this. And he presented the situation that I guess it just encouraged him to do the right thing. And he kind of appears that he separates the two issues, redeeming the land and taking Ruth as a wife. He deals with the simplest matter first. And maybe it's easy to read this and you think, okay, he senses that a windfall's coming his way. Gets land. Yeah, I'll do it. I'll take it. It's my right. And then he comes to him and says, yeah, legally, you have this opportunity to buy this land. But the women, they are in dire circumstances. You need to make up your mind right now. Do you want to buy the land? And if you don't want to buy it, I'll buy it. And okay, so he says, I'll redeem it. And it's really to our dismay that if you're reading at that point, you're like, oh, that's too bad. It says verse 4, I'll redeem it. And you expect to, read something about a sword fight, you know. Oh, yeah. You can't have Ruth. So it seems there's a setback. And the irony of the setback is that it's caused by him doing the right thing. It's caused by righteousness. And the guy says, basically, oh, shucks, I'll take it. And maybe he was surprised that Boaz was honest enough to tell him and to present. I don't know. But the tension is heightened at this point. It's all over for Boaz, Ruth, and Naomi. God's plan has failed. Their hope was in vain. We could say Boaz's love is dashed upon the rocks. But just when we're about to say, oh no, stop the story, don't let this other guy take Ruth, Boaz keeps talking. In verse 5, he tells them some details. And this is where verse 5, he says, on the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you must acquire Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of the deceased, in order to raise up a name to the deceased on his inheritance. And really what Boaz understood was it's necessary to preserve the land for the house of Elimelech. But it also necessitated the preservation of an heir for Elimelech. And he wanted to preserve the property of Elimelech so that the heir could grow up on the land. And he understood that there's a close connection between Israel and the land. And so he paints a picture that it's obviously not an optimal deal. He wants to discover the true motives of this man, the care for Ruth and her family. But then this is when he reveals, look, it comes with some strings attached, wedding strings. Naomi's daughter-in-law must be taken as a wife to complete the transaction. Oh, you know, something just came up. I forgot. You know, that's what it seems like. He's like, I can't redeem it for myself in verse 6. And really, to, I guess, our relief, in verse 6, he says, I can't do that. Perhaps, I don't know if he was married already, but he may have been married and he didn't want to complicate his own life. He didn't want to complicate the lives of those that were in his family. He didn't want to jeopardize his inheritance. So Boaz says, I can't redeem the land. And he gave it to Boaz. And whatever the reason, you know, pretty much we're cheering, you know, oh, good. Whew. But he doesn't have the motives nor the maybe the character to rise to the occasion that she needed to be provided for. One commentator said it this way, kind of sums it up best. His words clearly express concern only for his own patrimony and interests. They show no concern for Ruth in the line of Elimelech at all. Thus, unwilling to shoulder his full responsibilities as a redeemer with the prior right, he summons Boaz to acquire his rights. So the unnamed redeemer refuses his right to the land. He refuses to redeem Ruth and the property of Naomi. And it's kind of makes you gasp as he says it. You know, he refers to Naomi and Ruth as, you know, I'm not going to redeem it. And, you know, we're like, whew, this is good. So he's not interested in Ruth or Naomi. He's interested in the land. It's going to cost him something. And he passes the right to Boaz. And then in verse 7, the narrator's explanation of the custom of removing one's sandal. And rather than signing a contract in those days, they would take off their sandal and they'd hand it to the person that was involved in the transaction. That made it legal. And
did he get the sandal back?
Well,
does he go one shoe on, one shoe off?
That is the scene I see. You're fading out. You know how the picture and the credits start going. He's shuffling down the road, and he's got one sandal on. He's going down this dusty road, and really, the story started with death. Started with death. Ruth and Naomi, it's going to end up in life. And this guy is, maybe that's why his name's protected, because, it's a shameful thing to to if he had the right and he had the responsibilities to reject that. And so when he gives a sandal over, that is going to be, I mean, that means he is acquiring the property of Elimelech, and he's taking on the responsibility of providing for her, for his widow, and he's marrying Ruth.
Question. Yeah. If, you know, he's paying a good hunk of money to get this piece of property, and because he finds out it's not going to be his, because if he has a son with Ruth, it's going to go to that son.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so it won't ever be part of his inheritance, and yet he's going to put all that money into it and get nothing out of it except for the use of it until the son can inherit it. So maybe he doesn't have the money to do
that. May be the situation.
And protect whatever else he has.
Yeah, so. he's got his own things to worry about. So that is a distinct possibility, and probably true in some respect.
Yeah, but to the point that you said earlier, the fact that this man was unaware of the details of Naomi and Ruth is significant as the closest redeemer. He should have been aware. He should have already been involved. If he knew it was going to be a problem for his inheritance, he would have known Boaz was a wealthy man and could easily take on a wife, and Boaz was unmarried, and he could have then gone about it to say, I would care for them, but I can't marry Ruth.
Yeah.
You're in the perfect position. Would you do it? I mean, he could have done all of that, and that would have said he cared for Ruth and Naomi, but yeah. That's not what we read.
Yeah, he doesn't. He showed by his actions that he's not concerned about her. And Ruth, there's a lot of contrast in this story. Ruth took the extraordinary path with Naomi by committing her life to the one true God. Orpah, on the other hand, or Orpah. Orpah. Did I say Oprah?
Yeah, you said Oprah. Oprah Winfrey.
Yeah.
She was back then.
Orpah took the practical and, you know, reasonable way back to Moab. Boaz, he takes the extraordinary path to redeem Ruth and Naomi. He demonstrates chesed beyond what the law said, and it approaches grace on his part. And the unrenamed redeemer, on his part, he was interested in purchasing the rights to the land out of really practical economic reasons, but he had no interest and chose not to do it because he was going to acquire this responsibility, and he couldn't for economic reasons. And it's interesting that both this closest relative, the kinsman's redeemer, we don't hear him again. We don't hear of Orpah. We don't hear of her again. And it's the writer makes it a point to show this person. And again, you have, I guess you could say, you see Orpah, I mean, in your mind's eye, going back on the road to Moab, and you see this guy going down with one flip-flop, and they're both never heard of again. So Boaz addresses the elders and the people in verses 9 through 10. This guy fades from the scenes, and Boaz makes a speech in front of the elders, in front of the people that were gathered here at the gate. He says, I intend to marry Ruth. Verse 9, he said to the elders and all the people, "You are witnesses today that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and Mahlon." Verse 10, "Moreover, I have acquired Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of Mahlon, to be my wife in order to raise up a name of the deceased on his inheritance, so that the name of the deceased will not be cut off from his brothers or from the court of his birthplace. You are witnesses today." And he's just saying in so many words, I buy the land. I'm going to take care of Naomi. I'll marry Ruth. I'll honor the deceased husband. We'll have a child, and we're going to perpetuate the family line. And again, we looked at last week, Boaz has no legal obligation to do this. It's just pure grace. It's chesed, the Hebrew word. The other man was obligated to do it, but Boaz is doing it not by obligation. He's motivated by his love. His love for God's law, God's command, and really Ruth. You know, I will redeem her. I want to be her husband. I want to have a child with her. I want to, you know, raise up a descendant who will grow and receive the inheritance. And this way, the name of Elimelech and Mahlon will go on. It will not be forgotten. And so the witnesses testify to what they've seen, and then they offer a prayer in verses 11 through 12, and we've got time to look at those. So verse 11, all the people who were in the court and all the elders said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, both of whom built the house of Israel. And may you achieve wealth in Ephratah and become famous in Bethlehem. Moreover, may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, through the offspring which the Lord will give you by this young woman." And so they understand some things here that are happening. So Boaz publicly declares his intentions. And there's another problem here, but I'll save that for next time. Yeah, and again, there's a lot of contrasts between just as Boaz became the Redeemer for Ruth and Naomi, Jesus Christ is our Redeemer. And I think he's foreshadowing the ultimate redemption that would come. It's the ultimate redemption that Jesus Christ brought. And I've got some things here I've listed. Just as Boaz blessed and cared for Ruth and Naomi, so Jesus also loves, blesses, and cares for his people, the church. Just as Boaz performed grace-like chesed in redeeming Ruth, so Jesus redeems us through his grace and mercy and love, and we don't deserve it. You write down Titus 3, 5, and 6. We don't deserve it. Just as Boaz was a man of wealth and was able to pay the price of redemption, so Jesus lived a sinless life and was able to pay the redemption of his people through his shed blood on the cross. And 1 Corinthians 6, we were bought with a price. And just as Boaz did all the work in chapter 4 to redeem Ruth, Jesus did all the work of our redemption. And just as the work of Boaz was final, so is the work of Jesus Christ final. And Jesus Christ's sacrifice was enough. And we know the scriptures say there was no other way. He provided for us the redemption, and we are redeemed by the blood of Jesus Christ. So, any comments? Sorry, I thought, we need to get through this. I didn't mean to just storm through that, but anything that you have a question about or observed in this passage?